Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden is with us today as our first guest. He is chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He's been in the Senate from Delaware since 1973 and was the only Democratic candidate not to attend the yearly COAST Forum over the weekend, the forum that we talked about on yesterday's show. Reason? He was on a book tour, which now brings him here. The book is called Promises to Keep. And Senator Biden, so nice to have you. Welcome to WNYC.
I'm delighted to be on. Thank you for the opportunity.
Interesting choice, first of all. More days of a book tour rather than the COAST Convention, which represents the growing net roots wing of the party. Did you do the right thing?
Yes, I did the right thing. I think that the COAST Convention, the Daily Cause, is worthwhile, but it's a part of the party, and I'll have many opportunities to speak to them. We also invited, my staff was there, invited the participants that I would be prepared to participate in any online operations they'd like to set up for me in Iowa or anywhere else I am.
We'll get to the book in a minute, but what do you think of the net roots wing of the party? Very anti-war, very interested in universal health care, radicalized by the Bush administration, probably outraged at the Senate's acquiescence last week to expanding warrantless surveillance. Are they the new moral core of the party?
Well, I think the moral core of the party continues to still be the core of the party that was there, the African-American leadership, the leadership that has been the moral center of the party for some time. I think they've joined it, and I think that's good. But I don't think they are the moral core of the party. The outrage was shared not only by them about what the Senate did. Was outrage was shared by me. It's the reason I voted against giving the president this authority. And the reason why I have been so vocal about it being time to tell the truth to the American people. We can't slip into the pattern which is observed happened in the past, where in order to satisfy a vocal minority or a vocal majority in the party, we don't tell them the straight, honest facts. I have every major initiative we voted on to end the war has been either written by me, co-drafted by me, or initiated by me with others. And so I am very, very, very angry about this war. But I also think it's important we tell the American people the truth. And the truth is, if we end the war tomorrow, which we should, it's going to take somewhere between 10 months and a year to bring every American troop home. Yet if you listen to if you read the blogs, you'd think that somehow by saying we're going to end the war tomorrow, we're going to end the war tomorrow. We're going to be able to bring forces home. It takes lots of time to withdraw troops, even if we leave all the equipment behind. And what are we going to do with the 4,000 civilians we have in there? We're going to let them just be left there to die? We're going to not take any action to remove them? And then you'll hear people say, well, we have to protect them. Well, you have to protect them. It's going to take somewhere around 10,000 forces to protect them. So I just think it's important that we be as honest as we are vocal.
Senator,
I'm not making any reference to any particular blogger or any particular one of my opponents, but I am making generic reference to the fact that it's time to tell the truth.
Senator Joe Biden, my guest.
No matter what happens, this is going to be very, very difficult.
Senator Joe Biden, his new book is called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. And, Senator, of all the things that you've done in your career, the quote that you use on the back cover of the book is about leading the fight against the Robert Bork nomination to the Supreme Court in the 1980s. And you won. Do you consider that one of your most important accomplishments?
Well, I do. Imagine what the court would look like today had Robert Bork been the sitting member to this day instead of Kennedy, who is not the best thing in the world from my perspective, but at least occasionally he votes the right way. Imagine what it would have been the last 15 to 20 years had Robert Bork been on the bench instead of Justice Souter. I think it would have radically changed where we are, and we're already in trouble. We have a court that has moved way to the right, has, in my view, walked away from basic fundamental premises of constitutional law. And it's the reason why I worked so very hard and was criticized for being, quote, so persistently questioning of Roberts and Alito, both of whom I felt would be a disaster for the court, and both of whom, when they were up, I suggested would their being in the court would literally jeopardize civil rights and civil liberties. And I think what I've projected and what I've said has turned out to be true.
You have a whole list in the book, as you recall, the history of radical positions that Bork had taken that you used as ideological ammunition against him rather than trying to personally smear him as had happened with previous nominees. Do you think, though, that John Roberts and Samuel Alito, who have much nicer, more agreeable personalities than Robert Bork, are kind of Borks in sheep's clothing?
Absolutely, positively. They are. There's not very much of a difference at all philosophically between them. The one thing you had to give Robert Bork credit for, he was a man of his conviction. He defended his positions, whereas you had, in my view, both Alito as well as Roberts not being completely forthright in their testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, asserting that they had this expansive view of civil rights and rights
and respect
that were unenumerated in the Constitution, and I believe they do not have them. I think if you take a look at how they voted since I'm in the court, I have turned out my judgment was correct.
Was there anything about the campaign against Bork by you or by the interest groups that you consider unfair looking back? You know, the Republicans use it as a verb now, to Bork someone,
yes,
meaning to exaggerate their radicalism.
I do think there were some things that were unfair, and at the time, I distanced myself from them. I thought the idea that to suggest that Bork didn't care about people, was cavalier about the rights of individuals. It wasn't that he didn't care and wasn't cavalier. Here's a guy, for example, who believed there was no right of a woman to choose under the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment, yet he was a contributor to Planned Parenthood. Here's a guy who I believe, I don't know this for a fact, but based on his actions as an individual judge and citizen, was very, very supportive of the idea of a woman's more expansive right, for a woman's right to determine whether to carry to term. Yet, he believed, as a matter of principle, that constitutionally no such right existed. So my argument with Bork wasn't about his what kind of man he was. It was about what his philosophy was. And in the past, I think it's fair to say, my conducting those hearings, what was so unusual about them, I just forthrightly said this is a matter of legitimate inquiry into the constitutional philosophy of a nominee. And up to now, up to that point in most of the 20th century, the argument had been used that as long as someone has not committed a crime of moral turpitude, was bright, was someone who understood the Constitution, then you had no basis upon which to be against him. And that's why there were so many attacks on justices, veiled attacks based upon their integrity, when in fact really what they were going after was their philosophy, and I wanted to be straight up about it.
Senator Biden, you were
revolutionary at the time.
Let me go on to another topic. You were among the candidates who criticized Senator Obama last week for his anti-terrorism address that included a threat to go into Pakistan to get Osama bin Laden if Pakistan knew where he was and didn't do it themselves. Would that really be such a bad thing?
No, I didn't criticize him for that. And by the way, that's been my position for the last 4 years. He's very new to it. I'm amazed it took him so long to figure it out. That wasn't my criticism. My criticism was that, and then, by the way, that is our policy. If there's actionable intelligence, we will act. It surprised me he didn't know it was our policy. What is the part that is that I was critical of is when you are going to deal on move on actionable intelligence, which is the term of art, as you know, that you not announce it. You do not put the country with which you're cooperating in a position where the leader of that country has to essentially acknowledge to his people that he has put his sovereign right to determine whether or not the borders will be breached ahead of time. That's not a smart thing to do. The way to do it is find the intelligence and move. So you do not put the leader, in this case Musharraf, in the position of being subject to the radical attack by the radicals in his country for being in the pocket of the United States of America. It's just not a very smart way to do it. The irony is, in order to get actionable intelligence, you need the cooperation of the government in Pakistan. You need the cooperation of the moderates within Pakistan, two different factions. And when you announce ahead of time that you're going to disregard their border and you're going to tell them what to do, it is highly unlikely you'll get that cooperation. It's a fairly naive assertion that Barack Obama made. That was my criticism.
His premise was that they already had not gotten the cooperation, right? That whatever had been done had been done.
Well, that's the reason why we had. Look, he doesn't understand. Let me be more precise. The fact of the matter is the reason why we have not gotten the cooperation in the last 10 months is because this administration, and I've been saying this in print and in speeches and on the floor and at the Council on Foreign Relations for over 2 years. What has happened here is, and most of my colleagues haven't quite figured it out, is that to the extent that this administration has demonstrated it is not willing to make the financial, military, and moral commitment to Afghanistan, it has convinced Musharraf that he has to make his own deal with the most radical elements in his country, majority of whom in the Western province are Pashtun, which is the very tribe that the majority of the Afghans are. And so in our absence of standing up to take on the Taliban and to take on Al-Qaeda, in Afghanistan and the western province of Pakistan, what has happened is Musharraf has decided that he's going to be hanging out there alone. So what did he do? He went and made a deal with the tribal chiefs along that border because it looked to him like we weren't willing to make the kind of commitment that would enable us to take down the Pashtun, take down the Taliban and take down Al-Qaeda. That's the reason why he has moved the way he has. He is not a fan of the Taliban, and he is not a fan of Al-Qaeda. They want to kill him and get rid of him. But when, in fact, when it appears as though there's an expression that a British general told me when I was in Bagram last. He said, if the big dog doesn't stay in the pen, the small dog won't stay either. We're the big dog, and we walked away. That's the reason for this. The best way to get Musharraf to cooperate is to make the kind of commitment that I call for 5 years ago. Every single year, including this year, I have moved to increase money for forces in Afghanistan that hasn't gotten the support of the very people who are now all of a sudden finding out there's a need to do something about Afghanistan. So the whole point here is, to the extent to which we want Pakistani cooperation, we better darn well have considerable commitment to Afghanistan, considerable forces committed to Afghanistan, and a considerable willingness to use that force without announcing ahead of time that that's what we're going to do, putting our our so-called friends in a position where they look like they've been co-opted.
So it was the announcing it ahead of time. It wasn't even the position of reserving that right. It was going public in that way.
The irony is that is our policy. He announced something that's been our policy for the last 5 years. The surprising point was he didn't know that.
Joe Biden
is our policy.
Joe Biden, my guess.
That is the formal policy of the United States government. The fact we didn't act on it is a reflection of the unwillingness of this administration to conduct the foreign policy in a way that's in our interest because they are so preoccupied with Iraq. So the part was that it was surprised me he didn't know it was our policy. Secondly, it surprised me that he would think it made sense to announce to the world we're going to do it rather than just do it, making the likelihood of being able to successfully do it diminish.
Senator Joe Biden, my guest on WNYC. His brand new book is called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. I want to play you two clips real quick of Rudy Giuliani from the Republican debate the other night. Here's the first one.
I just noticed the question before, Senator McCain said something. In four Democratic debates, not a single Democratic candidate said the word Islamic terrorism. Now that is taking political correctness to extremes.
Do you use that phrase, Islamic terrorism?
Yes, but the more accurate phrase is, if you're talking about terrorism, not all Islamic terrorism. It is radical fundamental terrorism. It is not just Rudy should go to school. It's not just Islamic terrorism. There's terrorism that exists throughout the world, including the Shining Path in Peru, including what's going on down in Venezuela, including what's happening in Colombia.
But they haven't declared war
in Africa.
But they haven't declared war on us like Al-Qaeda.
Enough on the facts.
But they haven't declared war on the United States like Al-Qaeda.
Oh, by the way, some of those very organizations have been cooperating with Al-Qaeda, and they're not Islamic.
Here's the other. Go ahead.
But what's the point? I have no problem saying Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic terrorism. It exists, and I have used that phrase. But one of the problems with the Republicans is they conflate everything under one banner. The reason why we're in such trouble in Iraq is Rudy and others continue to cling to the notion this has to do with Islamic fundamentalism. It has to do with a civil war. If every jihadist in the world, as I told the President of the United States personally, if the Lord came down and said, I guarantee you, every Islamic terrorist in the world is dead and gone, Mr. Giuliani, you still have a major war killing hundreds and thousands and wounding thousands of Americans in Iraq. But because these guys don't make any distinction between the kind of war we're facing and their ideological predisposition, we're in the trouble we're in.
Here's the other Giuliani clip.
I would do the same thing that I did as mayor of New York City, and that is I would restore hope, but for the people of the entire country. Hope that this country can do great things, grand things, that we can build our future on optimism, not this kind of defeatism that I hear from the Democratic candidates.
The Republicans say that a lot, that they're the optimists, and the Democrats run on defeatism. This isn't going well. This is not going to go well. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that's not what I run on. What I run on is that it's the greatest opportunity any president has had since Franklin Roosevelt to change the world. I point out that if I had been president of 9/11 or someone else had been president like John Kennedy in 9/11, I imagine you would have heard the following speech, not you didn't get it from Rudy, which was that, my fellow Americans, we've been dealt a tragic blow. We've lost 3,000 citizens. Our economy is in trouble, but like every generation before us, we will, in fact, be better for this. And I'm making two announcements today. One, I'm announcing I've called a meeting of the world's major powers to meet in Brussels to begin to plan the demise of the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. And secondly, I'm announcing an energy policy that will be painful. It will take some sacrifice, but it will free us from the iron grip of the oil oligarchs. And I expect your support. Who in America would have said no? But what did the Republicans say? They said shop, go to the mall. What did Rudy do with the Biden crime bill that put 100,000 cops on the street, many of which he used? He watched the president decimate it and end it without saying a word. What did he do about anything having to do with the 9/11 commission? $42 billion worth of recommendations still not acted upon. He's had lockjaw. He hasn't dared taken on the president for failure to implement them regarding the safety of the ports, with regarding the interoperability, with regarding the safety of our tunnels under New York City. There are six tunnels under New York City where 20 more people will sit in an aluminum tube today called a train car at rush hour than seven full 747s. They have no ventilation, no escape, no lighting. What has Rudy Giuliani done with the Biden proposal to rebuild those tunnels for a total of $600 million? Nothing. Nothing. They are not the party of hope. They're the party of the status quo. They're not the party of hope. They haven't done anything to raise America and unite it together.
You're from Delaware. And one thing that's always fascinated me about Delaware is the fact that so many banks and credit card companies seem to be located there, because I guess your state has these uniquely lax laws for companies like that, and then they're allowed to market nationally from any state. Is your state a subsidiary of MBNA?
No, NBNA doesn't even exist anymore, as you probably know. There is no NBNA, number one.
Or whatever the
big... if there's any state that has all of those, it's your state. You're sitting in New York, aren't you?
Yep.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
We're the hedge fund capital of the world. Aren't you sitting in New York, where the stock market resides, thankfully? Aren't you sitting in New York, where every major bank you're referencing exists? The fact of the matter is, the reason why people that, in fact, corporations incorporate in Delaware is nothing to do with the tax laws or their ability to market. It has to do with, we have a very friendly, and I dispute, but a very friendly court called the Chancery Court, where in disputes between stockholders and management, there's 100 years of case law that is friendlier to management as opposed to stockholders. And that's the reason why corporations incorporate in the state of Delaware.
One thing that I read, and this actually comes from Daily Coast in 2005, an article by someone named Mary Scott O'Connor, that Delaware credit card companies engage in predatory lending practices that flood us with these temporary low-rate credit cards, and then they go way up, and have helped force more Americans into bankruptcy. And she said, you were one of very few Democrats to vote for things like allowing senior citizens who go bankrupt to lose their homes under the bankruptcy reform of that year. What should people think about that?
She's absolutely wrong. Number one, that is incorrect. Number two, every single credit card company in America, regardless whether they're located, if they're the major credit card companies, have the same rules of disclosure and the same rules across the board. What did in the Bankruptcy Reform Act is I changed it. And by the way, a majority of Democrats, all but a few, voted for it, number one. Number two, what we did was, for the first time, we changed the law so that if you declared bankruptcy and you had child support payments and you had alimony payments, prior to this law being changed, it would enable you to suspend your payments to your children and to your wife. Under the new bankruptcy law, we insisted that they be moved to the front of the line. You can no longer do that, as you were able to do before the bankruptcy law was changed. Number two, no one is affected by the change in the bankruptcy law in any state in America if they are below the median income, which is $46,800. Number three, the whole notion of the idea that people can't declare bankruptcy, in fact, is not true. They clearly can declare bankruptcy, discharge all of their debts if they are in a position where they have no assets to pay, just like you do right now. If you have any assets other than your home or other than your automobile, you have to come up with a certain amount of money to pay off certain amount of debts if they're legitimately owed. It didn't change that at all. The part that people confuse is there are a lot of people who, in fact, declare bankruptcy because of health care costs, and that is an outrage. But it's not the fault of the bankruptcy system. It's the fault of us not having a national health care system. It'd be nice if they got their facts straight.
Which side of the hedge fund controversy are you on, since you brought it up? Apparently,
I think hedge funds should be taxed. I don't think they're taxed sufficiently. I think we should also get rid of the tax for the people in the top 1%. It's $85 billion a year. You have to have an average income. You have an average income in that category of $1.45 million. It's not to be punitive. It's to be fair.
So when Senator Schumer says the hedge fund consultant should be allowed to get taxed at the lower capital gains rate, as if they were a stock, I guess, you disagree with that?
I disagree with that. Yes.
Last thing.
Yes.
You were not at the COS forum, but you did take part in the YouTube debate. Do you think that YouTube is good for democracy?
Oh, I think they're both good for democracy. I think they're both very good for democracy. The only reason I didn't take part in the Daily Coast was because I had a commitment here in my the state of Delaware, where I agreed well ahead of time that I was going to do a book signing for in my state, and there was no way I could do both.
Right. I understand about that, but I'm just curious your thoughts about...
Oh, no, they're both good for democracy. Absolutely, positively, it's good for democracy. Look, one of the things that I think that a lot of elites in both parties and in the media misunderstand is American people are pretty darn smart. They can figure out the stuff that is malarkey, and they can figure out the stuff that's real. Some of the stuff that comes across with the bloggers is just pure garbage, just like it is in other parts of the press. A considerable part of it is extremely valuable information. And the same thing with YouTube and the Internet. People are able to filter out the part that's real and the part that's not. And so I have great faith in him, and I write about that extensively in my book. I have great faith in the ability of the American people. They have more grit, they have more guts, they have more intelligence, they have more capacity than either party gives them credit for. And one of the things that I feel very, very strongly about is we don't trust the American people's instincts enough. They're not afraid of raising any of the issues you and I have talked about. They're not afraid of taking them on. They know there are no easy answers, and they know we're fully capable of making this country a whole hell of a lot better, from getting ourselves national health care to getting out of Iraq in a rational way to seeing to it that we have an energy policy. They're not afraid. We should trust them more, but you got to tell them the truth.
Do you have a position on net neutrality legislation?
Yes, I happen to agree with your friends my friends in the Internet community. I just think that we should not be fooling around with it.
All right. Joe Biden, Senator from Delaware, running for president.
Thank you very much.
And now the author of Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. Thank you very much. We appreciate it a lot.
Thanks an awful lot. Bye-bye.
And we recorded that interview with Senator Biden yesterday afternoon for this morning's program. Coming up in a minute, the bankification of New York. Why do there now seem to be three branches on every corner? Brian Lehrer on WNYC.